Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 149 for June 30th, 2008. Bill Gates, not evil. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Audible.com. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. So we've got the panel here. Bill McCrone, of course, longtime editor of PC Magazine. John C. Dvorak, who is famous for so many things, including dvorak.org/blog, but also a longtime columnist at PC Magazine, among others. And Jerry Pournelle, for years, wrote the Chaos Manor column, the user column at Byte Magazine. And it's appropriate to have a bunch of old-timers today because Friday was Bill Gates' last day at Microsoft, or at least so they say. John's looking at the ceiling now. Am I driving you crazy already?
You know, I'm telling you, this Bill Gates thing is a bunch of PR BS.
He's not leaving? He's not going anywhere?
Well, you know, just to get right to it, I have a column running in PCMag.com on Monday, which kind of expresses my feelings. If he's still on the board of directors as the chairman, this is not retiring. Retiring is leaving the company.
Well, he's not going to be there for day-to-day.
So what?
Okay, well, it's been a great show. I thank you all for joining us. I thought we could do, you know, kind of so long, Bill. We hardly knew ye, you know.
We hardly knew
some
him.
Great story. We probably
yesterday. He was in our face constantly.
Yeah, we knew him way too well.
We knew him all too well, yes.
Yesterday's count, I've been doing a count on a daily basis of how many articles are redundant articles about Bill Gates quitting. And it's been running about 900 a day different.
Jeez.
And then it hit 1,100. It hit 1,000 on Thursday. Then it hit 1,100 on Friday. And so I did the count yesterday on Saturday. Yeah. And it was 1,600.
Holy cow. But it's a great story.
What's the story?
I'll tell you the story. I'll set it up since you don't want to give me the time of day. The story is...
It's 311, by the way.
The story
311
is...
311 it is. 311.
The story is, here's a guy who, 32 years ago, 33 years ago, was undergraduate at Harvard. He gets all excited about the MITS Altair computer, writes BASIC for it without even access to the machine.
Allen wrote the BASIC.
Well, he and Paul Allen, whoever did it, they, without access to the machine, they write an emulator, they write the BASIC, they fly to Albuquerque, they pray it works, it does work. They start a little business with just a handful of people, very geeky looking people, if you look at those old pictures, that eventually becomes one of the great success stories of all time. He creates an industry where none existed. It created an industry about selling software.
There's plenty of it. Now, you're taking the tack that Bill Gates invented the business.
I'm saying
even though his software ran on CPM and would have done just, and the whole business would have done just fine if it wasn't for, you know, if he existed or not.
Well, but I guess my position is that he invented the notion that you could pay for software. Don't you think before
CPM
Bill Gates...
CPM wasn't free. And worse than that, I know. You know, see, the problem is I'm here with you now, so you have to actually deal with.
I have to deal with you. I could just ignore you otherwise.
The difference also is that during that era, when the competitor was
CPM was basically free. You got it.
There was a license involved with CPM.
No, it wasn't free, but you did have to write BIOS for it for most of the machines.
Yeah, no, that's the part. The fix of all that crap was not really until Windows came out in the 90s. But let's go back to this.
So what is Bill Gates? What is his accomplishment?
I don't think that he really has one.
I do.
Okay, well, maybe Jerry knows.
Jerry Pournelle, why should we credit Bill Gates with anything?
Unlike Jobs, Gates really did have the vision of a computer in every house and on every desk and in every classroom. And he really meant it.
They had that written. That was the mission statement for Microsoft. It had it written in concrete as you come up the path at Microsoft and Redmond. But people always leave out the last part. A computer in every whatever office, home, desk, running Microsoft software.
Well, That's fine, but the first part of it is the real vision, and nobody else had it.
So the idea of ubiquitous computing.
Yeah.
I think that that's something you can give him credit for. Absolutely.
IBM didn't have that vision. IBM had a vision of 100,000 computers all running IBM software.
Let me mention one more thing. Okay, I'll give him credit for that, and that's probably a good observation. Although I'm not absolutely sure that he didn't lift that from David Bunnell when Bunnell was at MITS or who knows what. But let's say that he's got that down. I think, to be honest about it, I think his real genius, which was explored in an early interview done with him in PC Magazine, and I don't know it's before or after Ziff Davis took it over, but there was this long interview with Bill Gates where he talked about the fact that you could write bloated software, and seriously, and he saw the fact that you could write this kind of bloated software, and the CPUs were going to improve so much on a yearly basis that it didn't make any difference, and so you could really, you know.
Well, he certainly lived that dream.
Yeah, now actually the software's never gotten as. I mean, it used to be more. You can't do bloated software jokes anymore because the CPUs and the hard disk.
He was right.
Yeah, no, he was dead on. It was a weird concept, and it was a very, that was visionary.
Correct me then. So you're saying that he wasn't the first company to really make software be a viable business proposition.
For heaven's sake, Gary was doing reasonably well with digital research. It isn't as if that company were doomed. The problem is, Gary didn't have the kind of ambition that Gates had.
Well, no one has the kind of ambition that Bill Gates had.
I understand, but Gary wouldn't have thought in terms of 100 million computers.
Right. So it was really Bill Gates' grandiosity that made him unique.
I think it was focus.
Focus is another word for it.
Grand vision and focus,
yes. Yeah. Is it the case that he really isn't a technologist, that his real skill set was as in business, you think?
I think it became that, but I think initially he was a coder. I mean, that's what he always bragged about.
Right.
He was a hell of a programmer. You did not want to go head-to-head with Gates in a programming contest. Believe me.
Right. We sent our best guy. We sent Charlie Petzold to compete with him, and he lost.
Compete how? Yeah. How?
That actually is the story I had in mind.
Tell me that story, Bill McCurry.
Jerry, you were there, right? I think Jerry was there.
Well,
but
you go on. It was your guy, but yeah. Nobody was better than Gates in those days.
Well, so Jerry, what's the story? There was a competition?
Yes.
There were plenty of them.
But Bill would say, okay, come on, I'm going to take you on. Who can beat me? Who can
beat
me?
Match.
Who's the best programmer in the world? What do you mean?
Exactly.
Exactly.
He would have coding contests. And
talk about hubris. What era is this? Is this 84, 81? When is this?
This is in the 286 to 386 era.
83.
It was later than
that. 84.
Let's see.
85. I'll get it.
Keep going. A little higher.
86, 87. But, but it was, you know, in the late 80s.
There were earlier ones than that, too.
Yeah.
In the 286.
PM 83.
So how would these, Jerry, how would these competitions go? They would, would you have a problem set that you had to solve? How did this work?
That was the one I was at, was that you had a problem set to solve. Use any language you want.
What language did Gates use?
Try to get something to run.
What language?
Basic.
He used Basic. And Charlie Petzl did what?
He actually wrote in assembler.
Wow.
Which he set himself a really wicked task, but he decided...
Could you bring your own macros or anything, or you had to start from scratch?
Well, you would bring your own programming library, but you had no idea what the problem was until you got there.
Right. Do you remember what the problem was in this particular competition?
Yeah, you had to draw circles of varying sizes on the screen.
So this is kind of, I think this is something that people who know the Bill Gates of our era probably find a little hard to believe. So he was actually in there programming. He would sit down at the computer and write the software.
Oh, yeah.
Wait a minute. Let's put it in perspective here. Trivia question of the moment is, what was the last product that Bill Gates actually wrote code for? Jerry, you probably know this.
I probably know it and don't remember it.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll jog your memory, and it was the TRS-80 Model 100.
Oh, jeez.
Okay.
Which is a 1983 machine.
The basic for that?
No, he wrote part of the operating system, rewrote the basic for it, and did a couple of other odds and ends, wrote some of the I.O. stuff.
Well, that's pretty impressive. Nothing to knock, either. That's one of the great computers of all time.
And Isaac Asimov used the damn thing till the day he died.
You're kidding. Really? That's what he wrote on?
I'm not.
Wow.
I am not
great
kidding.
If he,
Isaac
but,
loved the Trash 80.
But he wrote no other commercial code after that. Hmm. What he did was desk review. And that's when some of those infamous incidents happened where he would climb up on the table and scream and throw printout around saying, I could write better code in my sleep. And... and kick piles of printout over and yell at people and have tantrums.
But he had some credibility in that. I mean, if this guy's a good programmer, you listen to him, right? Otherwise, you just laugh when he does something like that.
It might well have been true.
Yeah.
Yeah, he scared people into doing a better job.
Well, I remember, I've talked about this book many times because it's still one of my favorite books as a budding programmer. It's a Microsoft book called Programmers at Work, and they have a chapter with Bill Gates on it. And he proudly shows how tight and concise his early original basic code was. And you could tell he took great pride in the fact that he wrote such tight code. I mean, that was the thing he was most proud of.
Well, we all did then.
You had to.
Well, let me bring up an anecdote then.
All right.
Right.
In the book Barbarians and Bill Gates.
There's a book. There's a Barbarians at the Gate.
No, that's the one about Nabisco. Barbarians and Bill Gates, which was written by Pam Edstrom's daughter and one of the head guys at Microsoft.
Oh, nice Gewurz, by the way. Yes, thank you for suggesting that. That's good.
And a guy who was, you guys might remember who it was, but it's one of the guys who was the head of Windows Project. And it's a story about Windows and how they changed the name because it was going to be something stupid. And he tells the story that he was looking at some advanced code, supposedly, and I guess it was in Windows. And he looked at it and he says, this is unbelievably bad. This is the worst code I've ever read. It's like amateurish and crummy. This is in the book, by the way. And he says he turns around. It was Bill Gates. And he found out later it was Bill Gates who wrote that code.
Somehow I knew that was coming.
You guys don't read the book, I guess. It's a good book if you wanted the real history of Windows.
So is Bill Gates the programmer that he seems to think he is or not? That's the question. We've talked about this before. I remember, John, I've talked about this with you for years.
Yeah.
If you give me a second, I'll answer that.
All right, I'll give you a second.
It depends on what you mean by how good a programmer. What Gates did was exactly what John pointed out in that interview. He understood Moore's Law.
Right.
If you can make it run at all, ship it.
Right.
Because the hardware will bail you out.
Right.
IBM never understood that.
They kept trying to write tight code.
IBM was going to make it perfect before they shipped it. The result was what you see. Now, is that good programming? It certainly is good, given the way the world works.
It's pragmatic.
But more than that, it was foreseeably good.
Yeah.
It was the right strategy.
Right. I think that's a reasonable.
I think it was genius.
Point of view. I mean.
And Vista is the latest example of that.
Yeah. Good enough.
Vista on a quad, 6600 or better, works just fine.
Yeah.
But I sure don't like it on a Core 2 Duo of an earlier era.
Steve Jobs, when they were designing the Macintosh, is famous for saying, great artists ship. If you don't get it out...
Yeah, what good is it?
What good is it?
It's like me and my book on the Depression.
we'll see it someday.
Where's that book?
Let's hope it happens before the Depression, because nobody's going to want it after the Depression.
It'll be out shortly.
Is it? Shortly is when? Like a month?
What am I doing sitting here?
When do you get to work, Dvorak?
John? Send me a review copy.
I'll send you some proofs.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, yeah. Really? It's already in proof?
When I get it in proofs, I'll send you some proofs. I got to go through one other editor guy who's going to help me organize.
I understood him. He'll send proofs.
He spoke the words.
I'm speaking the lingo.
The lingo, the writer's lingo.
We make our living writing books, you know.
So let's address this. Then there's no reason to say to write the epitaph for Bill Gates. He's still going to be just as much of a player at Microsoft. He's just going to be.
Well, according to my column running on Monday in PCMag.com.
Did you mention that yet? Because I think we should probably give that a little plug there.
I'm of the belief that we're going to hear more from Bill, not less.
More? Yeah. Publicly more?
Yeah.
Well, so I believe
you're
right.
He's going to be more of a pest than he ever was when he actually had to work the day-to-day.
I wish he were more of a... When I read that email that he sent out, we talked about this last week, a few years ago, bemoaning how hard it was to use Microsoft's website and download updates. I thought, gosh, that's right on. I think we should hear more of that kind of Bill Gates.
Well,
I hope he's beating up on Microsoft like that.
Could be.
He's apparently not making any headway.
Well, he certainly hasn't since that memo.
Maybe that's the case.
I want to hear more from him, but not in computers. I want him to change the world. If he would put up a $10 billion prize for the first outfit to put 31 Americans on the moon and keep them there alive and well for 3 years and a day, he would be remembered when Isabella the Great is long forgotten.
Well, maybe he's paying attention.
He might be listening to this.
Bill? Well, he's going to spend $30 or $40 billion on philanthropy. $10 billion of that on the is that all it would take, Jerry?
It's all it would take me to do it as a prize.
Like the X Prize.
Spend it.
Like the X Prize, yeah.
Right. The first outfit that does it gets the money.
Well, how much is Google putting up for the, trip to Mars? What is it, Google's X Prize, the new X Prize?
It's like $100 million, but they put so many rules around it that nobody seems to want to compete for it.
I wonder if they can keep 35 people alive in Redmond.
Not without life support.
Oh, well, that's harsh. I mean, Microsoft is not. Yeah, I mean, okay, it's a demanding place to work for, but it's still not the tech prize that it once was, but it's still a place where you can, as a programmer, contribute a lot and make stuff happen.
Have you ever heard the story of why the offices are all the same size?
No, why?
Gordon Ledwin took a tape measure to Chris Peters' office and discovered Chris Peters had 2 more feet of room in his office. And Ledwin went mad. And Gates said, that did it. And from that point on, they were all identical.
Huh.
Right.
That could be true.
Right.
I totally believe that.
That is true.
I tried to do that at Tech TV, but nobody would listen.
You wanted a bigger office or a bigger cubicle?
I just wanted an office.
Good luck.
any office would have done. So will Microsoft be a better place, a more productive place, a more successful company without Bill at the helm?
No.
Why not?
I don't think Ballmer has vision. I think Ballmer is a captive of the bottom line boys. And I don't believe Gates ever was truly dedicated to just the bottom line.
He wasn't the bean counter that Ballmer is.
Yes.
Bill McCrone, do you agree?
I don't see Steve as so much a bean counter. I mean, Steve is, you know, I've been there, you know, at times when I guess I wasn't supposed to be, and I snuck into the back of rooms and watched him haranguing the troops and firing up the salespeople and so forth.
He's good at that.
He really is. And we've certainly seen the Monkey Boy and some of the other videos.
Developers. Yeah. But that's his job, right? That was his job. Anyway, yeah.
Yes. And he remains really good at that stuff. So I give him a lot of credit where that goes. And I've also been in situations, and interestingly, they've all three that I can think of off the top of my head have involved Intel, where there has been some kind of an impasse that I and others felt would hurt the industry between Intel and Microsoft. and I got to at least mediate or officiate or bring people to the table in three instances. One was the Lotus Intel memory spec, which became the Lotus Intel Microsoft spec. The other one was that crazy fax modem spec that involved memory again. What was that called? I'm drawing a blank on it. And the third was benchmarking, the whole Windstones thing, which was a huge behind-the-scenes battle between Microsoft and Intel. Each wanted control over the benchmark,
So much so, pretty ugly. So much so that I made my own benchmarks. That was in the 286, 386 era. And
well, Winston, yes.
Go invented ahead. My own.
Right, I remember that.
That's, yeah.
Was that... that wasn't the CIV benchmark. No, that wasn't you.
No, the one I did was inverting matrices.
Oh, that's
because
right.
Because it uses both floating point and integer
I remember that,
arithmetic and uses a lot of it. So
yeah, that was a pretty cruel benchmark, as I recall. but the interesting point about Steve was that when push came to shove, it was Steve who came to the table and negotiated with the Intel guys and, told me, okay, we're about to make the sausage, Bill. You can leave the room.
Oh, interesting. So Bill would leave. Bill would actually leave.
You wanted Bill McCrone to leave.
Oh, Bill McCrone.
No, Bill McCrone had to leave because, role was just to get them together.
Right.
And make them see each other's viewpoints and why it was good or bad for the industry. And then get out of there. But Gates never was involved with that stuff. It was always Steve who would, be butting heads for months and then finally see the light, I guess.
I always thought of Bill as being a tough negotiator, though. Was Bill not a good negotiator?
I don't know. I never negotiated with him.
It seems to me like, I don't know, the deal that he made for DOS, for instance, that was a good deal. But who made that deal?
We have to talk to Patterson to figure out what really happened there. Yeah. I mean, I know it was kind of a scam of a deal. But, maybe what McCrone is saying here is that the two of them may have been better partnered up that way. Because
like Lennon and McCartney.
Because without Gates, I just, Ballmer's a guy, I liked Steve, but I can't even imagine him sitting at a computer.
No, he doesn't seem like a tech guy at all.
Yeah.
He's a salesman.
Yeah, he's like a sales guy.
He's the guy you want to motivate the sales force. I've known a million of him. He's the guy, the general sales manager at every radio station I've ever worked at. That's who he is.
Now, I understand. I never said he was a bean counter. I said he is more likely to be influenced by them.
Yes.
I don't think he has the kinds of vision. Gates is a guy that once he focuses on a vision, it takes sledgehammers to get him off it.
Well, John, you want to weigh in on this? I mean, you've been one of the people who said that the Microsoft is going to be a better company without Bill Gates. You still?
I did.
Didn't you? Am I wrong?
If I did, it was a passing thought.
It was a passing fancy. So, I may be misquoting you. I don't want to misquote.
Well, I think it's going to be a different company. In fact, in my MarketWatch column, which ran last week at MarketWatch.com.
Is that that's a different one though? Is there, you get one per?
Oh, I'm
maybe
sorry.
Two.
Well, I've got, that was one an hour.
Okay.
So anyway,
I got the clock.
And we're at 3:30.
Plug all you want.
So anyway, I thought that Microsoft would tend to fall into the role of kind of a Honeywell or a Unisys.
Jeez.
Without Gates.
That's depressing.
Well, they're big money. They're just not interested.
Unisys. Are they still around?
Yeah,
They make banking systems.
Honeywell, are they still around?
Yeah. I have a fan that says Honeywell.
Unisys is not only around. They have a very nice conference house over in the south of France near Marseille. They took me over there a couple of years ago to spend 2 weeks lecturing to their senior Visionaries and things.
But do they have fine pate and Jarlsberg and a Gewürztraminer? I mean, I don't know if there is.
Oh, they have. Believe me.
They're in France. I'm sure there's some good wine and cheese in France.
There must be something there.
You have not been to a better luxury hotel than the Unisys Conference House.
I'll keep that in mind the next time I get an invitation from
them. I'm going to work
it
out.
My wife keeps bashing on me to take her back there sometime.
Maybe it'd be more apt to say Microsoft would be kind of like an IBM.
I think IBM is becoming like Unisys and Honeywell.
Yep.
They're all the same. They're
more
all
infrastructure, less vision,
going
more
in the direction of
solid
services and boring, high-end enterprise crap.
Wait a minute. What company files gets more patent awards?
IBM's got all. John taught me that.
Year in, year out. John taught me always.
I know, but IBM is slowly giving up that whole part of the business. When they sell Vermont Junction or whatever it is, their last microprocessor development area fab, I think it's over.
They're still doing a lot of basic research, and there's darn few companies who are anymore.
They sold Almaden Research to Hitachi. I just think it's a downhill slide.
Is there a natural kind of life cycle in tech companies? I mean, is Microsoft at the kind of the downhill slope?
Happens pretty fast, doesn't it?
It does happen. Well, they're 30 years old. That's a long time in tech.
But one thing is, Microsoft seems to have lost its soul in the last few years.
Well, isn't Bill Gates Microsoft's soul? Who better?
But he somehow wasn't.
He lost interest. He got married, had kids, found philanthropy. He lost interest.
That's a piece of it. But they used to be a code house. They used to make money selling code.
That was the original
money. They don't do that anymore.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore.
That's the old Bill Gates speech that I always was so fond of. He used to give this great speech about what they did, which was make and sell code.
And yes.
Yeah.
So I want to hear some stories. I want you old time. I brought you old timers on for a reason. I want to hear some stories about that. Thank you, Jerry. I want to hear some stories.
Jerry, we're going to have to edit your coughing out.
No. That's what
I'm sorry. I need to get a cough button on this damn Microsoft phone. I push the button and it flashes red for mute.
It mutes us, not you. That's the problem.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
No, it's all right. I think it's great. As soon as I say old timers, there we go. No, but the reason you guys on is I wanted to have people who go back to the beginning with Bill Gates who have some stories to tell. I mean, John, you used to give speeches with a video of Bill Gates. You'd take his speech and you'd edit it all down, and you used a video toaster, which is a precursor to this TriCaster.
Right, the video I made was I cut one of his keynotes at CES, and he swallows a lot while he's talking. He kind of swallows.
I think they trained that out of him later.
And makes a little gulping thing. He goes, and so I edited it together so there's nothing but that. And it went 5 minutes.
That's a good video.
That's five minutes out of 45 was just gulping. That's pretty cool.
He's never been, but you know, that's part of his charm. He's never been a great front man. He's a geek.
Well, you know, one of the memorable speeches he gave once when he was pushing the CD-ROM business, information at your fingertips was his keyword, which I was told was stolen from what's the name of Gibson? Bill,
William Gibson?
No, not that one. Who's the name of Bill? The guy who was one of, he was there was like Gates, Jobs, and then the guy who ran the personal software.
Yeah. Gibbons.
Fred Gibbons.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Fred Gibbons. Yeah.
Fred Gibbons.
He was the guy that thought up information at your fingertips.
Fred Gibbons came up to me one day about a few years after that term was going around. He comes up and he says, and this was after he had a stroke, which is really a problem. I feel bad about Fred having that stroke because he was one of the main players in the industry. He comes up to me and says, John, you got it. This is bull. This information at your fingertips, I'm the one who gave Bill the term. And he had this long anecdote about when he told Bill.
And
he just thought he was ripped off. And I wrote it up in a PC Magazine Inside Track, but, you know, nobody cares.
And it may even be true, but that is the whole point, isn't it? Gates was the guy who saw that CD-ROMs would change the world. and he put on that big conference.
They only changed the world for a year and a half, by the way. It was kind of a brief fling.
Because something else did.
Yeah.
But the point was that the readers went from the thousands of dollars down to under 100 in a very short period of time, and it really did change the world. Everything after that was incremental improvement. Now, once again, Gates had that vision.
And he had the pulpit from which
happen.
Yeah, he had the pulpit and the position and the power and to make
first
it happen.
Conference. You may remember that Philips had its own plan for marketing CD-ROM through record companies. And Philips came to his conference and rained on his picnic. And that was when Microsoft was a $12 billion company? And Philips was a $40 billion company? And they basically threatened him with ruin. Gates just went right ahead.
I think that's another thing that we probably don't remember very well, at least those of us who remember Bill Gates in the last few years, is Microsoft wasn't the dominant power until the last 10 years that it is today.
No, Lotus was kicking their ass early on.
Yeah. When did it turn for Microsoft? Was it with the Windows 95? When did Microsoft?
I think Windows 95 closed the door on everybody, but the real disappointment was the Lotus people were brain dead.
Yeah.
And there's this theory that goes around the industry. People bring it up, and both Jerry and Bill have heard it. And Sun brings it up occasionally, and pundits bring it up, which is that, it refers to Sun, actually. If Sun Microsystems had Bill Gates as the CEO, they'd be kicking Microsoft's butt.
It's just the guy,
because again, like Jerry says, he's focused. And he has a vision, and he sticks to it. I think with the CD-ROM thing, he stuck to it too long, which is why they missed the internet. But Apple missed the internet too, in a much bigger way. So,
make a good point about the guy at the helm because being over focused because Scott McNeely and Bill Joy could only think in terms of mini computers and distributed computing, and just like DEC. Ken Olson could only think in terms of DEC computers, but Bill has been extraordinarily facile in moving from technology to technology as long as Microsoft had a finger in the pie.
Well, and do remember why Gates was so agitated back in that period when Microsoft was not so dominant. The internet computer was going to put him out of business, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
They bragged.
May still, by the way, put him out of business. It just took longer than he thought.
Took a lot longer than you thought. Meanwhile, he had this running fight with IBM over OS 2. John, you were there. He had that big
John was a huge OS 2 fan. I remember that very well.
Well, but Gates had that big conference where we met over in Bellevue. And took buses out to the new campus, where he had a new building set up for press events. And he was putting on the big show, OS 2, and it was a compass, it was a guide for the future, and it was all going to be OS 2, that was the vision of the future. Gates gave his talk at like 8:30 in the morning. 9 o'clock, the IBM guy got up, and said, "I think that's wonderful. Now I got to go back to Florida," and left. And literally left. Well, I was at Bill's table at lunch. He had 6 glasses of wine.
Oh, man.
And you could see the steam coming out of his ears because he had just been dissed in front of the entire technology press and financial analysts. Community at what was supposed to have been his big show. It was another declaration of war. And
was that when the relations between IBM and Microsoft really took a dive?
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bill introduced the IBM guy as a friend.
Right.
And all of their charts showed Microsoft as this little piece doing presentation manager, but OS2 was the new coming operating system. And this guy, well, he defecated on him from a great height. He allowed it to reach terminal velocity. And then walked out of the room. I was sitting with Esther at the time. I looked over
Esther
and said,
Dyson.
Yeah. I said, Esther, this means war, doesn't it? And she said, you better believe it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a very volatile time because IBM wanted to reassert, I mean, it had lost hardware control of the PC market, but when you started at 100% of the market, the only way to go is down.
Right.
And they thought that OS2 would be their ticket to reasserting their control over the market.
Well, that and Microchannel.
Well, yeah, Microchannel was supposedly a hardware solution, but they forgot a few things along the way, like
compatibility.
The installed base.
Like trying to collect back license fees.
Well,
the stupidest business decision ever made. You want to license Microchannel? Fine. Pay us for the original PS bus. Sure.
Right.
So
good luck.
I thought
Before we finish that little thought on this transition period.
Yeah.
You also have to remember what a bunch of boneheads IBM were at the time, and the fact when they brought the PS3, they switched prematurely to the 3. And a lot of people don't remember what a big deal this was, but they prematurely switched to a 3.5 inch disk drive with really no 5.25 inch option, except a drive you could buy as an add-on that was the size of a truck.
It looked like an aircraft carrier, right?
And I would say 99% of the software at the time was being distributed on 5.25 inch discs.
So it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. Yeah. And wait, there's one more thing. They also brought out the PS2 line, and Bill, you'll remember this because we wrote about it extensively, with a series of monitors that were flat-out fuzzy.
Yeah, they were poor monitors. The 7514, I still remember ragging on it. but, Leo, you said a key word about Bill earlier, and pragmatic was the word you used. And I can give you a good example of Bill at his most pragmatic, and that was when the Lotus Intel memory spec was being developed. And if you recall, Lotus needed more than the PC's maximum memory in order to do its job. So they invented this wacko bank-switched memory scheme and kept it a deep, dark secret. And through a lot of digging, we finally figured out what it was, but we weren't sure how it was going to work. So they did a PC Magazine Technology Day up at Microsoft's campus. And every team that we went to, I closed the interview by asking, so how does this work with the new memory spec? And the PR guy, Marty Tucker, who was following us around, had no idea why I was asking this question. And sometimes I'd get a real technical answer, and sometimes I just get what planet are you from? Look. And so by the end of the day, our last meeting was with Bill, and it was comical because it was pure Bill. We were sitting in this conference room, and it was a long, narrow room, and there was a whiteboard down at one end, and we were all seated at the other end. And every time Bill wanted to make a point, he'd run down to the whiteboard, write on it, and then run back rather than, but that was his manic energy, part of his charm.
Yep.
We've all seen it.
But that's fun. I mean, that's actually kind of cool that we would do that. He's famous for jumping over chairs, right? That was one of his circus tricks.
Yes, he used to do that at our party. But,
at our party, you remember that night he damned there? I thought either he or Paul were going to throw one or the other over the side there at the hotel.
Well, now you got to tell that story.
I just want to finish up the
pregnancy. Go ahead. Yeah.
Because there is one juicy thing here where, at the end of his meeting, I said, so what are you, what do you think about this new memory spec? And he slams his fist on the conference table and he says, it's garbage. It's a kludge. And then he turns and looks at me and says, but we're going to do it.
There's the pragmatist right there. Mm-hmm. But there's also the engineer. That's one thing I love about talking about to engineers as opposed to marketing people is the world is black and white for them. It either works or it doesn't work. And they'll tell you the truth.
Well, I'll tell you the one thing I always liked about Bill, even though over the years he's taken a dislike to me.
Has he really?
Oh, yeah. And that's because I'm not...
You were on the enemies list. You were on Marty Talker's enemies
list. Well, I don't know that's true, but it's possible. But anyway, I was on a list where I was banned from getting any information. I have the documents. It showed up in that Combs versus Microsoft case.
Oh, really?
Up in Iowa. Somebody sent me a whole bunch of the documents. Hey, check this out. You're on these lists. And I was on the list. Says, do not send this guy anything.
Oh, man.
So anyway, so I don't know what the deal was. But one thing I have to say, you could always go up to Bill and ask him, so what have you seen that's interesting? And you could do that anytime, and he'd always rattle off about six or seven really cool things you've never heard of. And if you were a columnist like myself, and you take a mental note or write it down, right. You had some really good material. This guy would have been a gold mine if I could get a hold of him more often.
Yeah, I used to do that every year at WinHack. I was never on their bad list. I always went to WinHack. Bill always showed up at the party that night. And I would ask him exactly that question, that what have you seen that's interesting? And, man, it was hard to stop him.
Yeah, he was. That's what I think the difference between him and Ballmer is that I can't imagine Ballmer ever doing that because I still can't see Steve at a terminal.
He's not a technologist in the way Bill was.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yep. Although Esther Dyson once tried to explain, I think we were on the Charlie Rose show or something, and Charlie's first question was, when 95? Why now? And I said, because it's a year late. And,
and of course, Rose wouldn't get it.
No, that's a funny thing.
No. But Steve Lohr and Esther did. But the funny thing was that Esther tried to paint Bill as a non-technologist.
Really?
Well, Bill isn't really technical. And
that's a surprise.
And I said, well, I guess...
I'm not buying it.
He wasn't one of her visionary crowd that she was hanging out with at the time.
Weren't they dating? Though? Didn't Bill and Esther date for a little bit?
No, never.
No.
She dated Bill Ziffer.
I don't believe so. Yeah. I don't believe so.
No, never.
No, she's not Bill's type.
Yeah. Heidi Rosen he dated, but that's another story.
Right.
I don't think we need to go into Bill's love life.
Oh, why not?
So let's talk about a 30-inch vertical leap. I mean, this guy could leap as high as Michael Jordan.
Straight up, too, not a running start. We're talking from a standing start.
He tucks his legs. It's not the same thing as a true vertical leap.
Oh, see, this is why he doesn't like you, John. You're dissing his vertical leap.
Oh, who cares about it? But, you know, the one thing he was good at was ping pong. And I'll give you another story. No, sir, you think it's funny. He was like a major league ping pong player.
I don't know why. I'm not surprised in the least.
And then he took up golf because his wife, the golf story is actually kind of interesting. He took up golf because his wife played a credible game and he couldn't see a woman beating. He couldn't, you know, Bill's not a very athletic person naturally. But he hired a full-time coach. And he played, and his dad used to golf, and so he played and played and played, and he was coached and coached and coached. And I've talked to this coach once, and he says, you know, Bill is not, he plays a credible game now after, you know, years and years of being coached, and he can actually play a good round of golf. And so he's part of that group of golfers who are CEO golfers, which is like a club.
He prefers bridge, though.
And the other thing is his bridge game.
He and Buffett play bridge nonstop.
So one time, you want these Gates anecdotes. So one time, and I won't reveal the source of this because I wasn't there secondhand, but apparently they took, you know, Bill liked to take the rent an entire train and for the friends of Bill and then go traipsing around some part of the world, like the Orient Express maybe.
He does this every year. This is like his big vacation.
I don't know if he's still doing it.
Yeah.
But whatever the case is, one time he did one in the Grand Canyon. So he rents this train, and he gets special permission. And this is from a story from somebody on the train, and it wouldn't take much to figure out who I'm talking about. But anyway, so he gets the special permission to go on a kind of a semi-abandoned track that's actually in the bottom of the Grand Canyon, giving some of the most spectacular views in the world.
Permission and some money, no doubt.
Well, maybe. So he has a bunch of... And meanwhile... apparently, during the entire trip, Warren and him, and I guess another couple of people, played bridge the entire trip and never once looked out the window.
And were they playing for money?
I don't know.
You got to think a penny a point.
Yeah, I would think. Well, Buffett for sure.
I've heard that story too. So I think that sounds like a true story.
Yeah, well, they don't care. They're not. These are not guys. Buffett included.
They're not into the view.
They're not. They don't care about seeing the scenery. They're making their money and playing bridge or whatever.
So, Jerry, did you have the ability to call Bill at any time and say, "Hey, Bill, what's going on?" Or
for a while. But I'll tell you something. Until he got married, anybody did.
Oh, yeah, it was the wife that got in the way, huh?
All you had to do was call the Microsoft switchboard at about 10 o'clock at night on a Friday night.
That's who was home. Did he answer the phone?
Nobody. He answered the phone himself.
Microsoft.
I actually
Is that your Bill Gates?
Microsoft.
I won $100 from, I won't tell you who it is, but he's a pretty well-known journalist, saying, "I can have you talking to Bill Gates tonight, right now."
Oh, that's because hysterical.
No, come on, can't. Tell us, Jerry.
No, I'm not going to. But anyway, I dialed it, handed him this guy the phone, and said, "He'll answer it."
Microsoft.
I didn't want it. Well, Bill knew my voice. I damn well wasn't going to say anything myself.
Hi, it's Microsoft. Who can I talk to? Who do you want to talk to?
I got my $100 too.
He's answering at his own phone. And this, by the way, this isn't when there's 20 employees. This is much later.
Yeah, but that ended.
That's all right.
It ended in the mid-90s. But yes, I used to could call him in the daytime, even after he married. I got along with Marty all right, because Marty understood that I wouldn't waste Bill's time with long, rambling nonsense. Let Bill talk as long as he wanted to, and then I'd cut him off saying, "I gotta go." If necessary.
Bill, I'm sorry. I don't have any more time. I gotta go.
But what Marty was worried about was, and the same with Pam Ebstrom, either one of them could get through to him, and they're both old friends. What they were worried about was people wasting Bill's time.
Sure. Well, you only got one Bill Gates. You got a big company to run.
He called me once, too.
My phone rang. I picked it up and said, "Hi, this is Bill Gates. You're about to run a story I don't like."
Really?
Yeah. I've been there, done that.
It was all true. Remember that business when the rumor was that they had spiked up one of the versions of Windows that if you ran a pirated copy, it would trash your hard disk.
Ooh. And that they did that, really?
No, they did not. Oh. But a terrible thing happened. A summer hire at Microsoft put into the code. They did a test to see if it was a pirated copy, but it did nothing. Except a summer hire put into the code a message. "I see you're using a pirated copy. Now trashing your hard disk."
Oh.
Yep, I remember that.
That's all it did.
It didn't actually trash your hard disk. It just scared the hell out of you.
It did. But at the exact same time, there was a virus that set things up so that a file was never closed. And anything you wrote to the disk went into that file until it overflowed and blew everything up. Now, you hadn't lost anything except what you'd saved to that bad file. That had nothing to do with the message, you understand. And Bill basically called to tell me, "Look, it was a summer hire, put in this stupid message, and it has nothing to do with the real problem. And the way you solve the real problem is this way." Hmm. Gave me a damn good column.
I bet it did. Do you remember? You remember him calling you, Bill?
Yes, several times.
To complain?
Yeah.
Where else would he call?
To say hi.
Sometimes he would
invite you to a bridge game.
We were at a I guess it was one of the developer forums, or no, it must have been either the Dyson forum or one of those things. And he was on a panel, and I was sitting in the audience. And as the room was emptying out, he stood up from behind the cloth covered table and started yelling at me. That review of Microsoft Project was so unfair. And
that's good, by the way.
That's better than yours.
Bill McCrone has now officially the best Bill Gates
that's
impression.
It's kind of a swallowing your thing.
It's a little Kermit the Frog kind of a
little
thing.
Bit.
Yeah,
exactly. But he harangued me for about 5 minutes. People who were leaving the room stopped dead in their tracks. They all turned around. They started filing back in.
Sure, that's a kind of notoriety, Bill. That's something to be proud of. That's
I think
great.
I remember that one. Yeah,
you're probably there, Jerry.
Too bad you didn't have a bunch of magic tricks you could have done right then.
Bill, I'd like to impress you with my magic now.
let's get on to
well, Gates. I first met.
Oh. Go ahead, Bill.
All right. Okay. First of all, your audience probably doesn't know that he was an instant sleeper.
I don't even know what an instant sleeper is.
He did not require any time to fall asleep. He was like Thomas Alva Edison. He could nap anywhere, anytime. And when he was on planes, he always flew coach. And I remember seeing him many times on San Francisco to Seattle kinds of runs and things like that. And he was always the guy with the blanket pulled over his head.
He's famous for like arriving at the airport 1 minute before the gate closes.
Yes, and there's a great story about that, too, because it was a contest, because he and Ballmer would travel. Actually, all of the top guys would do this, and they had kind of a running thing to see who
could late
make
you could leave.
Who could run from Redmond to Seattle and dump the car and so forth. And Bill told me one time that he won it. Hands down, that no one would ever beat his time, which was like 17 minutes. But there was a caveat, and that was that he left his Jaguar running in outside the terminal.
That's what happens when you're worth billions. I don't need the Jag. I'm going to make the plane.
Oh, it was one of those old 3.8s. It was really a disreputable car. But he kept it forever. And he had to call from the plane and ask somebody to come down to
him. Hey, Steve, will you go turn the Jag off? I left it running.
Well, I'm sure it was towed in no time.
No, this is pre-911. I'm sure it was there. All right. That's funny. So he could. Yeah. So he would get in the plane. He would cover his head with a blanket.
You know who else does that? Esther Dyson.
Again with Esther.
I wonder if they got that from each other.
Maybe they taught each other the trick.
Esther would, she was into yoga, and she would fold herself up like a jackknife, like put her feet up vertically, and with her feet on the back of the, her calves on the back of the seat in front of her, and fall asleep. It was the most astounding thing. Oh, and Bill hated when all of his other employees would upgrade and sit in first class. For some reason, Bill thought that, buying a coach ticket and flying coach, no matter how many miles you had, was the thing to
he
do.
He doesn't fly coach anymore,
well,
does he?
Besides
he
that,
doesn't fly commercial anymore.
Yeah.
But this was... This
well,
was
no,
in
the late
day.
That, Bill, I saw Gates a couple of times, and by 1995, he was still buying coach tickets, but he was not flying coach, I can assure you. I was on a Delta flight with him, and it was like... They literally dragged him out of coach.
They wouldn't let him fly coach.
Put him in first class and kicked somebody out of first class, some poor schmuck who actually paid for a ticket.
Well, if Nick Nolte showed up and is sitting back in the coach, they're going to drag him up front.
Maybe.
I mean, they're not. That's not. That's just the way the airline's going to do it. It's not going to.
Depends on whether he combs his hair. But whatever. But I got to tell you. So.
I have a rim shot.
Anyway, I don't think he's flown coach since the mid-90s.
Yep. Fly commercial anymore.
Well, I'm sure he flies his own net
jet. Well, he's got he's got a Challenger.
He has what's a Challenger? Is that a
big
private
jet that you can stand up in?
Yeah,
it's like a G5. It's one of the big. Pornell probably knows what it is.
Yeah, sure. Got to fly out to my DCX launching in one of those.
Oh, how fun!
Well, Congressman Rohrabacher arranged it, of course. Not my airplane.
You want real money, go to a congressman. Those are the guys.
Yeah, those are the guys.
Those are the guys.
Belonged to McDonnell Douglas. Yeah. But,
So did Congressman Rohrabacher, I understand.
No.
Okay, right. Sorry.
Well, it certainly was the biggest employer in his district.
Yeah.
So
it's mutual.
He's certainly going to pay attention to that.
Absolutely, you know? Absolutely.
I don't think you've had anything to do with one another.
So,
you know, Dana was my student as an undergraduate, so he's a little afraid of me to this day, I think.
Oh, that's funny. So what other Bill Gates stories do we... I remember, you know, I've read all the trashy biographies of Bill Gates. And
we're probably overdue for another one.
Yeah, we are.
I'll tell you, when I met him, I went to... You remember the Southern California Computer Society?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Well... They met at Harvard School, which is about a mile from where I am. And I went to one once. This is before I was writing for Byte, just as I was beginning to. I had an old Cromemco.
Cromemco. Wow.
Cromemco, yes. And CPM.
S-100.
S-100 bus. And I went to this, and here is this squirt. I mean, this kid who is selling Altair Basic on paper tapes.
Mm-hmm.
The meetings were two nights, and he's selling them for $20. And he's hawking them out of a bag he's got of them. And the next day, everybody else is selling copies for $5.
He was pissed about that.
He almost went out of his mind. I think that was the night on which he really got this bug about piracy.
That's quite a famous...
He went to the Homebrew Computer
I was going to say Homebrew was where he's famous for that speech about...
Came out.
You're stealing my tapes. Stop stealing my tapes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this was about a week earlier than that meeting. He had come... He was making all the Computer Society meetings. And SCCS in those days was bigger than Homebrew.
Yeah.
Says you.
Well,
a little North-South competition.
says a Los Angelino. Yes, right.
Bill is famous for being kind of an autodidact. They talk about in one of these books, vacationing with a girlfriend at the time, Ann Winblad of Hummer Winblad, and bringing with him... big books about biotech, the red books of lectures of surely you guessed, Mr. Feynman.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And just really loved to learn stuff more than
he never got his degree, so he never relaxed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I don't read anything.
Yeah, you got your degree.
got
nothing to prove.
I don't need to.
You can relax.
I let people tell me stuff.
Yeah. I just listen. I don't need to learn. People would tell me. If I didn't know it, I'm sure somebody would tell me it.
It's a fact.
Well, you know, I read a lot, and I've got a couple of doctorates, and I'm supposed to know something about a lot of things. I don't believe I ever struck up a conversation with Gates in which he didn't know. Maybe not as much as I did about the subject, but he was certainly up there with what I would have said would have been my best student.
He was a smart guy. There's no doubt about that, right?
He reads a lot. He remembers a lot. And he organizes what he knows pretty well.
Some say he had a photographic memory. Would you say that's the case or no?
I have no idea.
No.
I don't think so.
I think he's just voracious.
Yeah, voracious. Yeah.
And well, it would depend on... Leo, it would depend on when. I had an eidetic memory until I was about 21.
It's all downhill after that, isn't it, Jerry?
It's one reason I got interested in Dianetics for a while. I thought I could get my eidetic memory back.
Oh, really?
You can't.
Were you a Scientologist, Jerry?
No, Scientology didn't exist in 1950.
Well, you were probably friends with Ron, though, right? I mean, you must have known him.
I never met Ron. But I read his book, and of course, Mr. Heinlein, who was one of Ron's friends, was a good friend of mine.
Right.
But no, I thought maybe it would work. I could get my photographic memory back, but in fact, you could not. It didn't work for me, at least.
Oh, maybe I could get one in the first place. That would be nice.
Why?
I don't know. Then I'd remember stuff.
Nah, you can just something to brag about. It's useless.
No, you have the internet now. You don't need it.
You know, Google.
Yeah, you
is,
got Google.
I got what they call Google assisted memory. It's so much
that's
better.
That's an astute observation.
Yeah.
Google pretty well does substitute for an eidetic memory, so long as you can remember enough of a phrase to have a unique hit.
I think that's absolutely true. I tell you, during the radio show, frequently I'll pull up what I need to know from Google fast enough that it sounds like I'm actually remembering something.
It's unbelievable.
You've heard me do it.
Yeah. So let's bring up one more issue here, which is that what do you guys think about the commentary by Steve that Microsoft is going to generate more than half of its income in the future based on advertising revenues?
That's a pleasant fiction.
Wishful thinking.
That's where they're going, though, right? That's where they want to go is online. Mesh advertising.
Yeah. You know, the market economy isn't big enough to support that. And I'm just saying that off the top of my head, but I'm sure I could Google up something that would prove it. But I just don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
And not only that, what would be the point? I said in one of my columns that Microsoft dodged a bullet when the Yahoo deal fell through. It was the best thing that could ever happen to them.
I've said the same thing from the first day I heard that rumor.
Yeah. So, the problem is, within 3 years, we're going to have 64 core CPUs. 64 core.
Within how long? 3 years?
Four.
Wow.
Three or four?
Yeah. Are you one of those people that believes the singularity is near, the Ray Kurzweil singularity?
No.
I've had that argument with Ray, and no, I don't. But the point is, we're going to have computers that have what amounts to infinite computing power, infinite memory, and infinite mass storage. And we have got software that can't strain what we have now. The people that are going to make money are the ones who are going to figure out how a guy who knows how to do something useful and doesn't care about computer science can sit down and teach the damn machine to do something useful without having to spend 4 years learning to program.
Never happen.
Given all that computing power, I think it will happen.
Never happen, Jerry. You're living in a dream world.
We've talked about this before, though, the notion
Texas Instruments essentially gave up on natural language programming. They worked at it for a while, and they did some fairly impressive stuff, but the hardware limits were just too good, no good. They couldn't do it.
You're saying that they're going to catch up. Hardware's going to catch up now.
Well, the hardware has gone way ahead. What I'm saying is that the people who can write software to make use of this bloody hardware are the ones that are going to get rich.
Yeah.
The heck with advertising. Advertising.
Well, how long before computers start writing their own software? I mean, why do humans even write software?
Computer-assisted programming was a big deal during the 80s. It went away. I never hear of it anymore.
Yeah,
because it never worked.
I think it didn't work, but again, the hardware couldn't support it. Just as
you know, Jerry, not to be argumentative,
but why not?
But you know, I remember the first time I saw voice recognition stuff from IBM, and they kept it. There's this promise. It'll work eventually. Now, let me just say the one thing that I've subscribed to, and I picked this up very early on in the late 1970s from Lee Felsenstein of all people, who was the original architect of the
and a homebrew computer and club early member.
He made this interesting comment that I've always thought was interest was he made an interesting comment that I always thought was salient.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw in a word there just to
I
see
needed
if it worked.
One. Anyway, Lee says, you know, it's just like with horses.
It is.
He says with horses, you had, you know, there were words that you could tell a horse to do, like, and he had like
you
G
can lead. You're
and
saying
jaw.
You can lead a horse to culture, but you can't
you
make
can
it think.
Horses do not understand plain English. Dogs don't either.
No.
And the fact that, but they do understand certain kinds of commands when they're said in a certain harsh way. So we've adapted to the animal so they would understand us as the best we can. And he always felt that you have to adapt to the limitations of the machine, which will always be there. And in other words, you have to talk to the machine in a way the machine can understand you. And to expect more than that is crazy.
I don't disagree, but I think you can expect the machines to understand more. Look.
You know, I think that's the same.
It was always easier to write a program that would run properly in Pascal than it was in assembly language.
Again
or
with the Pascal. Jerry's
always
never going to let go of this Pascal thing.
I don't let go of strongly typed languages that are logically consistent and which find your mistakes in the compiler rather than your having to debug the damn thing after you get it compiled.
But I think that
now,
in a way...
The reason that Pascal and Modula and the other Vert-type languages didn't catch on is because they were slow. They were slow to compile, and their runtime packages were slow. We no longer have to worry about slow. I can't write a slow program for a Quad 6600.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because the language that we, you know, if any of us goes to our screen right now, we're executing XML, we're executing JavaScript, we're executing Java.
Very slow languages, but still we have enough horsepower.
Longhand, you know, and once was a time we worried about, you know, tight home pages, you know, like let's only send them like 9 or 11 or 16K of home page. Now, you know, any page you land on is half a megabyte, you know, and it's doing all kinds of stuff.
Now, Jeff Hawkins would say that it isn't the issue of speed, it's the issue of how they think, and that they can't ever really, computers just don't work the same way, that the von Neumann machine is just the wrong metaphor
for thinking.
Well, that's what they're trying to do at Numenta.
They always say that. They can't get anywhere.
Well, Numenta's trying to create a new kind of chip that thinks more like the human brain does.
As John McCarthy was fond of saying, the problem with big, massively parallel systems is that they are immune to programming.
Well, that may be another,
that's
another
cute.
Issue.
Yes, I like that. Yeah. That's a funny line.
Another issue entirely.
I got it.
I think we all did, John. You really don't need to glory in that. I think that was pretty obvious.
It's, oh, sorry.
All right, but coming back to our friend Bill Gates.
Oh, him.
He would be the first guy to jump on it if somebody had a breakthrough, or he'd be the second person to know about it, and he'd be all over it.
Well, he's only 52. I mean, he's not down and out.
Which gets us back to the original point. He's not really retired. This entire episode that we've been witnessing is nothing more than a grand publicity stunt, and we're going to see more of Bill than ever, and I'm actually already sick of it.
You might be right. But you know,
you put that far stronger than I would. I think he's buying himself more free time.
A little space.
But as chairman of the board, he can always come back.
Well, I would hope. I would like to see him maybe focus a little bit more on these bigger issues.
Me too.
And you know, he doesn't need to prove anything. He doesn't need to show himself, you know, the man times man of the year anymore. He maybe with a little free time, he can put that brain.
He's going for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, he might get it.
That's the thing. I mean, because he needs the money.
He needs the money. What is it, $1 million now? A krona?
Well, actually, the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, is given away in Norway. And the Nobel Prizes are given away in Sweden, Stockholm.
Well, there you
go. That's correct. That's correct.
So you don't get to meet
Norwegian
King.
Norwegian give away the Peace Prize, yes.
Why? How did that happen?
I don't know.
Norway and Sweden were the same kingdom when Nobel died.
Oh, I see.
And when they split apart, that was part of the provisions for dividing into two kingdoms.
You get the Peace Prize, we'll get the rest. I love
it. Wow, that's a really good factoid.
Jerry, it's so full of that stuff. I love it. That's the best. I love it. Hey, Jerry, how's Inferno 2 going, by the way?
Be out in January. They're talking about promoting it The title of the book apparently is going to be Escape from Hell.
Good.
And we're booked on some talk shows with themes like, are you going to burn in hell?
You and Larry Niven.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
That's great.
And Niven, God knows what Niven will say. I never do.
You stay out of that discussion?
No, I usually have to do most of the discussion. But then Larry will come, like with Lucifer's hammer. Here I'm trying to write a very accurate, technologically accurate book, right? Niven throws that damn surfer in, and that's the only thing
anybody remembers.
Ever remembered about the book. We got a huge review in Nature magazine this month. I mean, a really great review of a 30-year-old book.
Wow.
Amazing. But, of course, the first paragraph is about the damn surfer.
You sound bitter.
No, I'm not bitter. Look, I know Larry writes better than I do. I think better than he does.
There you go.
Between us, we write damn good books.
You make one pretty good novel.
There's not that many collaborative authorships like that. Congratulations.
It is kind of amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
No, Nordhoff and Hall with Mutiny on the Bounty is one of the few that's made more money than we have.
Wow.
As collaborators.
That's
right.
Pretty cool.
It's very difficult to do.
That's pretty cool. Well, Jerry, I really appreciate your joining us with some memories of Bill Gates. This was kind of a special twit, even though John says it's a
scam.
Scam, full of sound and fury and signifying nothing. I think it's worth spending a little time to think about this guy.
Well, you might as well pile on. I think it's a Guinness Book of Records thing going on here.
Yeah, well, let's face it. Whether or not he's retiring.
Britney Spears in total page views yesterday.
That's all I'm saying. You know, you could be a pregnant, fat. Never mind. I'm not going to go any farther than this. She's lost some weight. She looks good now.
Yeah.
Or you could be a geek. And he's doing it for us. He's doing it for the geeks of the world. I think whatever you say about Bill Gates, I think you can only say good things about what he's done for the technology industry and what he's done for personal computing. He's been a benefactor and a boon to it. Anybody disagree?
Agreed.
Oh, John, you're looking funny at me.
I think you're a bit much.
I've often wondered what would have happened if Dottie hadn't refused to sign that non-disclosure agreement and Gary and his outfit had been the ones to write the operating system for the IBM PC.
It wouldn't have been the same world. I mean, as you said, Digital Research could have written it, but they don't have the instinct.
Jerry, there's always a rule that was going and still believed in the Valley is the following. If some one company doesn't take over and dominate everything, some other company will take over and dominate everything. So it would have just been the same thing with a different company. And that's just the way the whole tech business has been, especially the tech business that stems from the semiconductor industry, which operates that way.
Yes, but suppose that company had been IBM.
Well, it was for 20 years in the 50s and 60s.
It could. It seems unlikely because they had already gone through their period of dominance. And I don't think they could. I've never seen a company do a comeback like that.
But then there was a compact to the IBM, and there were all of the Eagles to the compacts and the everybody else's. The industry was too big for any and had too much upside potential for any one company to dominate the hardware side, but it did need one company to call the shots on the operating.
That's partially true, Bill.
Exactly.
But one company did dominate the hardware side, Intel.
That's true. Infrastructure.
Oh, yeah.
You needed that Intel operating system. You need that consistent operating system to make it the whole ecology work.
It didn't have to
work.
Be Microsoft, though.
Well, it wasn't Apple.
Well, actually, it was Digital Research because they copied MS-DOS. Tim Patterson rewrote it as,
Right. CPM rewritten.
Bill
bought it for 50K.
Where is Tim Patterson these days, and why isn't he speaking up?
They gave him some money to shut up.
You know that in DOS 1, you could make Gary Kildall's name appear on your screen.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I never heard it. Gary showed it to me.
Really?
Yeah, there was
Oh, yeah.
How did you do that?
Oh, yeah. I don't
they
know.
Just he put his stuff through a code translator.
He wouldn't show me how.
So this was code that was left in by accident.
Right.
Left in by accident.
Well, that's pretty serious proof of the contention.
Well, yeah, which is why Kildall died a very rich man.
Uh-huh.
And why whoever owns CPM will never have a look and feel lawsuit.
Uh-huh. Who does own CPM?
It's all water under the bridge.
Well,
it's gone now.
That's why I got you old guys on.
Gone now.
Experts. Right. Experts on water under the bridge, ladies
that's
and gentlemen.
About it. We rock.
But I do wonder if Gary had done it, he didn't have the ambition Bill did. He would not have
that's what I think.
Tried to build an enormous software house out of it. He would have been happy to take the revenue from IBM and let IBM do it.
Right.
Interestingly,
now, whoever dominated the operating systems was going to have a lot of revenue. Would they have invested it in the ways that Bill did?
Single best deal probably in the last 50 years.
Good investment.
Was the deal to give IBM DOS without giving it to them, but licensing it, per copy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's another player that we're missing in the whole thing, and I don't want to. This show should be over by now, but
I was trying to wrap it up.
Let's
but that's
bring
okay.
up the one thing we got to remember: Seymour
Maybe
Rubenstein.
Maybe you'll get a second show.
We got to remember Seymour Rubenstein, who's the guy who promoted the concept of licensing shrink wrap licenses. Largely, his invention actually was taken from it, some ideas he had, and he was running. He was pretty much the dominant player until he was scammed out of his company while he was supposedly. Or they tricked him into thinking he was on his deathbed when he wasn't.
You're kidding.
Yeah, no, it's a great
There's
story.
There's a story.
It's a great story. And
Seymour, you're dying. Sign over WordStar.
Well, no, Seymour, you're dying. You got to sign some. You got to sign a proxy over for me to run. Run.
You who know, did that? Run, his family?
No, the guy who took over the company, Haney, I think was his name.
Well, there was some real scamming going on.
But whatever the case was, that company could have just as easily become some domineering company because they had the same kind of hardball style of marketing and pushing people around.
All you guys are convincing me of is that you needed a Bill Gates to make any of this work, and that Bill Gates was the guy, the only guy who was able to make it all
well,
happen.
Well, all we know, theoretically, but all we do know is that Bill was never really an evil person, so that's a plus.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
So
I liked him.
You liked him?
Yeah, well, I have to make it I still do, but
he's not he's a likable
guy. He's
not
going to telephone me anymore. It's not.
No, he doesn't telephone any of us, and he never will.
He's kind of good looking in this picture here.
It's not like we're going to pal around, but he still says hello to me. And
yeah, he says hello if he sees you.
Well, I'm glad we could do this show with some guys who still think Bill's a nice guy and not evil. johncdvorak.org/blog. Don't forget, of course. Tech5.
Tech5.mevio.com. Noagenda.mevio.com.
Crankygeeks.com.
PCMagazine.com. And MarketWatch.com.
Can you just get one? Dvorak.org/blog.
We're going to put a site together that just consolidates everything.
Yeah, I keep saying that too.
Yeah, I know. That's all I've been saying it for a while.
Jerry Pournelle, it's so great to have you on as usual. I'm glad you're feeling better. That's wonderful news.
Yeah, it's JerryPournelle.com.
We know that. We know that. The one place to go, Jerry's column is available now. You can subscribe to it, thecharismanoreviews.com, but just go to jerrypournelle.com. And please, Jerry, come back again soon. It's really great to hear from you. I'm glad your voice sounds so much better. You sound like you're in great spirits, great energy.
Really. After 50,000 rads of hard x-ray, I guarantee you.
I'm impressed.
It's great to be back.
I bet.
That'll wake you up.
Yeah. Good morning.
Yeah, Bill's character.
And Bill McCrone, you're the best. McCrone.net. I always give out that address, even though you don't really care. But
Well, I put a couple of more things there, but not much.
I do have to mention that this show is brought to you by the good folks at Audible.com. Have to. I'm always glad to. Audible sponsors all of our TWIT programs, and they are a really great source. Jerry, you have some books on Audible.com, I think.
Yes.
We did this last time.
And getting more.
And more?
My agent just made another deal. I don't know what they are, but I just got about $5,000 advances from Audible, so apparently some more of my stuff is going on there.
I couldn't be happier to hear that.
You're buying.
Yeah, no kidding. Lunch is on Jerry. I'm really...
You know, the only way to make a living in this business is to sell stuff you wrote 30 years ago.
It's not a bad way to make a living. It takes less work. Currently, Star Swarm, which is one of your juveniles, is up on there, but I look forward to more. They're doing their own sci-fi stuff now, which may be the deal that you made. I was over there on Monday, and they have, I think...
I think it was.
Yeah, I think they have 8 studios now. I recorded a... Short.
Oh, yeah. How'd you do in your recording?
It was really fun. I did a little kid's book.
Yeah, it's the best you can do. I wonder what you
it want. Had to be public domain.
I want Mutiny on the Bounty or something read by you.
Call me Ishmael. No, I did. I was fun. I was. They couldn't afford Little Red Riding Hood, so they got...
Mr. Christian!
They got Little Golden Riding Hood. It was, I guess, apparently the variant that was in public domain.
Oh, the original.
Maybe it is a prequel. It might be a prequel, like yeah. So I read that, and that was really fun. They're going to offer that for free. But they have many, many great books. And I have to say, the science fiction, I found out that, because the first time I went to Audible, which was in 2000, it was 8 years ago, that was underwhelmed by their science fiction selection. But I found out that one of their principals, their Foy, who's a great guy, is a huge science fiction fan. And he's done a yeoman-like job of getting some of the best sci-fi in the world on there. And it's growing all the time.
Telling me needs Moten God's eye.
I think you're right.
Hey, but by the way, we got Jerry. I wanted to ask you something, Jerry. Do you think you're underrepresented at that crazy Paul Allen Museum up in Seattle?
The Sci-Fi Museum. Yeah.
I mean, you know, the one thing that I found in that place.
Well, yeah, but remember what it was. Well, that was...
It was the Jimi Hendrix Museum.
It was the museum in Lincoln, Nebraska, from the University of Nebraska.
Oh, is that where he got that?
And he just bought it and turned it into that. So his legacy from a university science fiction club.
Well, he could have...
Jimmy Gunn's English department.
Oh, that's
so Jimmy Gunn, James Gunn is in there, for instance. Neither Niven nor I are.
Well, yeah, well, here's another one that cracked me up. I was going through that thing. I found it kind of insulting to a lot of the writers that were missing. And for example, they had some of those little tribbles David Gerald, I guess, was marketing, or somebody was selling these little balls of fur. They had them in there, but no mention of David Gerald in the entire place.
Yep, isn't that interesting?
Who's David Gerald?
David Gerald wrote The Trouble with Tribbles. He's a science fiction writer. He's a friend of Jerry's. We both know him.
Yeah. Hmm. David's a good writer.
I love him. He's a great guy.
So they're more into the merchandising than they are into their writers.
You know, I don't think anybody really pays attention.
It's not
to how
they need a curator. They need a curator.
Really,
it's ridiculous that museum
is not curated.
It's an embarrassment.
Somebody who knows what he's doing. They don't have Ron Hubbard in there. Now, you may think Hubbard was crazy or not.
He's got to be in there.
But it's significant.
He was enormously significant to the history of science.
Yeah, you bet.
And yet he's not in there.
Yeah, the whole thing is embarrassing.
The fact that I'm not in there may or may not be insignificant, but it is certainly bloody significant that Larry Niven is not in there.
Yeah. No, you should be in there.
Well, anyway. See, here's the thing I like about Audible.com. In the science fiction section, they've got they've now divided into alternate realities, classics, dramatizations, epic fantasy, hard sci-fi, which is my favorite category, short stories, space exploration, kid and young adults. They have a complete. They're getting the point now where they can really break it down. So
If you know those people, tell them that
I do.
It'd be a very good. Moten God's Eye would be a great thing for them to put in.
Yeah, that's a classic. That's an important book. They should put that in.
Jerry, from your lips to God's eye, I will tell Don Katz. And
it's coming up.
It's good. We'll get it in there for sure.
I think we're done.
But what you have to do, Jerry, is is come up with some little three-handed dolls, you know, with a big arm on one side and two little arms on the other side. And
I've already got a phrase that everybody's using on the one hand and on the other hand and on the gripping hand.
On the gripping hand. Yay. How did I feel that one go?
I love it.
Oh, seriously, if you get those into the museum shop, then you just follow on their little coattails.
I might point out that Jerry also claims credit for Tinstoffel.
Never heard of it.
Tanstoffel.
Tanstoffel, which...
There ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Did you give that to Heinlein?
Yes. I have a letter from Robert acknowledging it.
Now, I think that's significant.
What is it?
If you've learned one thing here today, you've learned that Tanstoffel was really... There ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
There ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Oh.
He's not impressed.
No, I'm very impressed. I'm totally impressed.
He's knocked out. He's just knocked
through. Right, sure sounded.
I'm going to wrap it up by just reminding you to go to audible.com/twit. That's the place to go. Sign up for Audible today. You can listen to great audiobooks read by the best readers in the world, the best books in the world, 50,000 strong, and great supporters of Twit. They love what we do. We love what they do. We invite you to sign up today for your free credit toward a book at audible.com/twit. Jerry Purnell, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Bill McCrone, you're the best.
Always a pleasure.
It's Bill. If it weren't for Bill, I never would have had a career in television.
That's true.
That is true. And you know, I meet young guys who listen to this show, and I tell them that, yeah, we recruited you way back when
for the original
DDTV.
That's right.
And they say, wow, that's great. You know Leo?
Someday they'll do the same thing to me. You know Colleen?
I am a friend of Leo's.
Well, I'm a friend of Bill's. Thank you. Yeah, we'll get that for you. Thank you, Bill McCrone. And John C. Dvorak, who gave me my start in radio. So, you know, I got all my benefactors here.
Wow.
Well, not radio per se, but in tech radio.
Yeah.
I was doing regular radio.
You were doing
No credibility as a tech guy.
I always like to. I don't know if Leo actually appreciates my mentioning this, but he is actually one of the few, probably many radio personalities that was actually bumped off the air
by
Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah. 550 of us were bumped off the air
Right? Is that number? So there should be a club.
We should have a little club.
The bump club.
Rush Limbaugh killed me and put me out of business, although he put me in business. Really.
He actually did you a favor.
If it weren't for Rush Limbaugh, I wouldn't be sitting here today on this small internet channel with probably more listeners and viewers than we ever had on radio. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week. Another Twit.
This is amazing.
Is in the can.
All right.
Do you want to do video also? We could do video.
Video's too hard.
Well,
forget
I guess
it.
We can do
Look
video.
At all I'm doing here. I mean, like, this is hard work.
He used to be a combo man at a radio station. He can't get over it.
All right. I should have paid attention. I don't know what I'm going to do. Too much work. The problem is, there's no limit. My server's completely collapsed. So here's the deal. I'm just trying to get the thing up, but I have a hell of a time. What blue screens? Like, forget it. I'm killing you.
Round the horn. Doing the twit.
All right. Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit.
I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic from the MedicCast podcast.
And I'm Mark Peltier from Futures in Biotech on Twit TV. We're here to ask you a really important question. Are you at risk for deep vein thrombosis or DVT? I was working on my computer for days on end. Little did I know that this would almost kill me.
You know, Mark, you're right. The CDC reports that between 30,000 and 60,000 people in the U.S. die every year from complications from DVT, a blood clot that forms in a large vein, usually in your legs. The sad part is, this is almost completely preventable.
So if only I'd stretch my legs every couple of hours or tap my toes, I would have avoided 3 days of intensive care, a week in the hospital, and 5 weeks on disability.
Absolutely. So for the listeners of this podcast, if you're sitting at your computer right now playing a game, if you're on a long drive listening to this show, make sure that you take the time to get up and walk around every couple of hours. And if you're sitting down, move your legs around, tap your toes or tap your heels. For more information on DVT and prevention, look at the link for the CDC in the show notes for this podcast. I'm Jamie Davis.
And I'm Mark Peltier. We want you to be a long-term listener to this podcast.